Bernie Sanders has no idea what is happening to him. And that is just kind of hilarious. Hello, welcome to The Pilgrim Show. I am Nate Moss, the Guru Pilgrim. And we're here for episode number 11, February 22nd, 2020. Ordinarily, this would be a live show, and it seems that it's been pretty much every other week that I go live and every other week that something comes up and I need to record, pre-record the show. You can get this show on Freedomizer Radio live, freedomizerradio.com, or and that would be Saturdays at 4:30 p.m. When I go live, and I try to do that somewhat frequently. I also have a podcast site, GuruPilgrim.com, where I hope to fill out that Guru Pilgrim brand a bit over time. And so we've got a lot to dig into. This week was quite an interesting week to follow. I knew that this was going to be an interesting year. I was just kind of excited all of last year to like get into 2020 and watch the politics unfold. It's been quite an adventure, and this week has been quite the highlight out of that adventure. We had the debate where Bloomberg was just incinerated, and yet a lot of people just don't care. So we've got that to talk about. And now, just breaking yesterday, was this whole issue of Russian interference in the 2020 election. So if you haven't heard about that, big deal. We'll talk about it. We'll break it down. I've got quite a view on that. I was looking into it. At first, I was like, what is going on? I'm not getting a whole story. And then Bernie Sanders' response just made it all click. And I was like, I got it. I know exactly what's going on now. So anyways, we'll dig into that. In technology, in the second segment, we're going to deal with a number of different things that have been going on, kind of across the map, across the spectrum. We've definitely got some things to talk about in regard to privacy, as usual, and Facebook, which is pretty typical. We're also going to talk a little bit about the world of IoT and Microsoft and some other things. Very exciting. And then at the end, the last segment of the show, we'll talk about animal behavior. That is the next thing on the circle of interest for the Guru Pilgrim, and sort of why that's important. Why is animal behavior a thing, and why is it important? So we'll talk about that at the end of the show here, segment number three. Let's dig into this. Next week, provided I'm live at 4:30, you could call in 319-527-6208. So write that number down, and hopefully I'll hear from you next week. So the debate, there was a Democrat debate here recently, and you had Bloomberg and Warren and Klobuchar, Mayor Pete, Sanders, and Biden. And I almost forgot about Biden. I was like, who was on the stage? Who was on the stage? And I was thinking of everybody, and I was like, oh, Biden, that's right, I forgot about him. He really wasn't prominent. He didn't really say a lot. He didn't really respond well. He responded, but he didn't respond, like, strong. It was just another person. And in fact, I was talking to somebody who's a Democrat just recently, and we were talking about the debate, and they were like, yeah, there's things that I like about each of them, but there's nothing that I like about, there's something that I dislike about each of them, too. And I thought that was a really, really great commentary coming from the left of what they see in these people. So there are things that leftists like about the Democrat candidates, but there isn't a single strong candidate for them, not even for them. None of them really, there's nobody that really stands out as the one. And in fact, this is kind of funny, Tyrus on Fox News has pitched the idea that, they should just bring everybody together, just one ticket, combine them all, and then they'll have something. And it was hilarious because this Democrat that I was talking to suggested the same thing. And I'm sure that they didn't watch Fox News and see Tyrus' suggestion. They just thought, we should just bring them all together and just have like a committee of president. And it was ironic because that's where they are. They don't have a single strong person. And of course, Bloomberg was just destroyed in the debate. He wasn't ready. He was clearly not ready. He bought his way to where he is. an absurd amount of money was spent on this up to this point to get him where he is. Just crazy amount of money. And here he is on the stage, and attacks were brought on him that were just expected. Things that you just have to know the people are going to level. And he had no solid response for any of those allegations and attacks. And it was kind of, I don't know, I would have been embarrassed. It was really a disaster. And the media, we're talking left-wing media and right-wing media, all agree that Bloomberg was destroyed. Here's the problem. He bought his way there. There is no other strong candidate. And he can buy his way past this. And I wouldn't be surprised if he does it. People are going to overlook these blatant hypocrisy issues because he's got money. That's going to be one of the things that they will do, which is kind of crazy. It's really crazy, actually. So Warren appeared really strong because she leveled some of those attacks on Bloomberg and really turned out to be a fighter. And she stood up for Klobuchar at one point. That was kind of funny because I'm looking at this going, why couldn't Klobuchar defend herself? Why does Warren have to step in and defend Klobuchar? And was like watching Klobuchar's face while this was happening going, okay, what is she thinking? Is she like happy that she's being defended, or is she worried that this is going to come across? It was kind of strange because it didn't really make Klobuchar look much better that someone else had to step in and defend her. Definitely Warren had a lot of positive comments said after the fact, too. So this was her strongest debate, I think. I think it would be fair to say. Mayor Pete continued to be Mayor Pete, a mayor from nowhere, just a little, you know, small-town mayor that nobody knows anything about, but is pretty articulate, knows what to say, when to say it, how to say it, can respond on the fly, which is a skill that none of the rest of them actually have. And he continues to demonstrate his ability to talk. But that's all we know about him. He can talk. That's great. And then Sanders, who just continued to be Sanders and lay out these, you know, his paradigm, his way of thinking. And we've got a lot to talk about Sanders here, actually, because of this whole Russian interference thing. All right, so what's this about? So this hit late Thursday, early Friday, and I'm looking at this going, what is going on? And nobody really, this was all fast. This was all just coming at us. What's going on? So here's how this happened. A person by the name of Shelby Pearson gave a classified briefing on Thursday to the House Intelligence Committee regarding election security. Okay, so this happens. This is an article from The Hill, which I'll link in the show notes here. The specific contents of Pearson's briefing are unknown, but Trump appeared to believe she had given information specifically to Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff that would be beneficial to Democrats if made public. Okay, so that was Trump's initial concern. Trump announced on Wednesday Ambassador to Germany Richard Grenell would take over from McGuire as acting intelligence chief. So, all right, let me try to break this down a little bit. Congress is briefed by the intelligence agency of Russian interference in the 2020 election on Thursday. The White House is not briefed until Friday. So on Thursday, when this happens, Trump is understandably upset because he wasn't briefed. The Congress was briefed first. That's a weird move. Why are they getting intelligence that the White House doesn't have? So that happens, and the intelligence chief obviously is perceived to be completely disloyal to Trump, which is understandable. How are you going to be regarded as a great intelligence chief if the first thing you do is you go to the Congress instead of to your commander-in-chief. You don't go to the commander-in-chief, you go to Congress. So that's definitely not a great move. Then we have an article from CBS News that quotes a source who attended the Hill meeting. Okay, so let's see what they have to say. A source, of course, unconfirmed source, so there's going to be as much media spin as you want. So in this, this source says, the message was, it appears they're favoring one candidate over another, and everyone should be cautious. Everybody should be cautious. This was a source that tells The Hill. Now, this breaks on late Thursday and early Friday, and the news is a candidate over another candidate is being favored. Okay, so naturally, everybody's like, oh, okay, it's got to be Trump. You know, this is happening again because of the media narrative about the 2016 election, which, by the way, if you're not familiar, the NSA, it has been discovered, has the capability of making attacks look like they came from Russia. And if the NSA can do it, they may not be the only ones. It's not too difficult to make an attack look like it came from somewhere else. What is hard is attribution. When it comes to cyber, if you're going to attribute an attack to somebody, you're hard-pressed to do it. There's no way to really verify that that happened. It is easy to fake where these attacks come from. We know that the DNC and the RNC were both attacked in cyber attacks. We know that the Republican National Committee defended it and was not broken into. And we know that the Democrat Committee was broken into. There was also a phishing attack, unrelated, on the Democrat side in 2016 that was successful. And got a whole bunch of emails and all of this. And we know that some people have Hillary Clinton's emails, but that was just, I mean, she had her emails on an unsecured server or a separate server away from the U.S. government, out of the control of the U.S. government. So all these things put together, there is no evidence that Russia actually interfered directly in the 2020 election, except for some social media moves that were there just to introduce some confusion. And the interesting thing of note there is that those social media posts and ads, first of all, it was a drop in the bucket as far as how much that was spent on that, like nothing, like $100,000, and then it was equally pro-Trump and anti-Trump. So they weren't here to try to make Trump win. That was clear from 2016. So when it comes along and we have Shelby Pearson making these claims, you know, hey, look, we have intelligence that Russia is involved in attacks. We know that those attacks were orchestrated on the left in 2016. Where are we now, right? So it says that she was not able to present a rock-solid case proving Russia's assistance, according to a senior administration official. House Intelligence Committee official denied there had been any bipartisan pushback on the briefing. So that's exciting. So there's very little bipartisan pushback, but that might mean that the leftists are like, oh yay, here we go. A day later, on February 14, intelligence officials briefed the White House on election security and also offered the same assessment that Russia, quote, is trying to help Mr. Trump win his re-election bid in 2020. Okay, so the news up to this point is that this is all about helping Trump, right? So Friday, Moscow denies that on Friday, both Moscow and Trump respond. Here's how they respond. Moscow denied that it's trying to interfere in the election. and helped Mr. Trump and said that the reports are the result of paranoia. Mr. Trump was also dismissive, tweeting on Friday another misinformation campaign is being launched by Democrats in Congress, saying that Russia prefers me to any of the do-nothing Democrat candidates who still have been unable to, after 2 weeks, count their votes in Iowa. So Trump simply responds with his perspective. Now, this immediate response continues. Hillary Clinton calls President Trump Putin's puppet and claims that he can't win without foreign help. The interesting thing about that is the immediacy. Hillary Clinton responds almost without having to breathe. So the question I have is, why does Hillary Clinton have to respond this quickly? Does she know that this report is coming? Is she anticipating this report? I'm just posing a question. So then later in Friday, and we're talking late Friday, like 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, there's new news around this whole issue. All of a sudden, it's not Trump. Now there's something else going on. And here's from another article that I'll also link in the show notes, GuruPilgrim.com. Intelligence officials have warned that Russia is attempting to interfere in the Democrat national presidential primary to aid Bernie Sanders, the current frontrunner, according to the Washington Post. This is important for a number of reasons. He is the frontrunner. It says even right here, Bernie Sanders frontrunner. The news lately has been Bernie is going to win this nomination, and there's very little that anybody can do about it. And the Democrats are scared about that because they don't want Bernie Sanders to win the nomination. To them, he is an outsider, a cult leader. All of these, he's part of this new movement to push our country even further left and take the Democrat Party with it. Go all full socialism. And Bernie Sanders is a leader in that movement. Well, establishment Democrats don't want that. They genuinely don't want Sanders. They don't want this concept of socialism to be touted. They want to be more gradual in their approach to this. Sanders said intelligence officials briefed his campaign on Russia interference a month ago and suggested that news was intentionally leaked to the Post in an attempt to damage his campaign ahead of the Nevada caucuses on Saturday. Oh. So maybe Hillary Clinton had some awareness. If Bernie had some awareness, who else had some awareness? How many people are involved in this? Where did it come from? I would pose to you that this has nothing to do with Russian interference. This is the same people causing interference in the 2020 election as caused interference in the 2016 election. The same people. They tried it once. They caused a whole stink. They got a special counsel. They got a lot of things that they wanted. They even were able to slow down this president's agenda for 2 years. Not stop it entirely, but definitely slow it down. Look at healthcare. Healthcare would have been very different in this country had they not succeeded in convincing Republicans that Russia interfered, when now this has been blown to smithereens. And the only people still trying to claim that Russia interfered are Democrat hacks. So Sanders, though, being targeted by the same mechanism that was targeting Trump, to me, I look at this and I go, okay, how can this be Russia? This is just blatant, right? This is, at this point, it's obvious what's going on. Sanders is as far left as you can go, and he is not going to favor Russia in any way. Trump is as far right as you can go in this political spectrum that and still get elected. And he is not exactly pro-Russia. Now, if you're Russia, I don't think you want either of these people. You don't want Sanders. You don't want Trump. You want somebody else. So why is Russia, or if you do, let's say you do, you're going to want one and not the other. These are like the polar opposites on this campaign. So you don't want one or the other. You want somebody else. Like, either you want Sanders or you want Trump, or you want neither of them if you're Russia. Which is just more of an indication this thing is orchestrated. So, Sanders responds to this thing. He denounces it. Here's a quote from Sanders. The intelligence community is telling us Russia is interfering in this campaign right now in 2020. And then he says, it's not clear what role they are going to play. We were told that Russia, maybe other countries, are going to get involved in this campaign. So Sanders, and then he denounces it. He makes a big deal about that. And there's a little bit more recent information, recent response. This is another article that I will link. It says Bernie Sanders on Friday warned Russia not to meddle in the Democrat presidential race, as Trump angrily dismissed the assertions that Moscow was again seeking to boost his election chances. Sanders says, unlike Donald Trump, I do not consider Russian President Vladimir Putin a good friend. He is an autocrat thug who is attempting to destroy democracy and crush dissent in Russia, Sanders said in a statement. I don't care, frankly, who Putin wants to be president. My message to Putin is clear. Stay out of American elections, and as president, I will make sure that you do. And that is where, when I saw Sanders' response, he's blissfully ignorant. He has no idea what's really going on. He thinks it's actually Russia. He thinks that it's actually Putin, and that this is all just a part of their attacks. He's trying to warn them not to do it. And it's hilarious because all that's going to do is stoke the fire. These people that are causing these so-called attacks are really, they're not Russians. And so calling out Russia for this is only going to make them more energized to continue. Trump, however, speaking at a rally in Las Vegas, says that he heard a rumor that Putin wants to make sure that I get elected. And then he says, wouldn't he rather have, let's say, Bernie, he says. He also tweeted out about this and called it a hoax and a misinformation campaign by Democrats, who still have been unable, after 2 weeks, to count their votes in Iowa. So that was, this is all quite the show. What's going to be interesting is seeing how this all goes down in the next few days, because, and really in the next few months, because they're not going to stop this narrative. They're going to continue this narrative that it was Russia. So the question is, who's going to be able to prove anything? What kinds of facts are we going to see that would indicate that Russia was interfering? If they want to push this narrative that Russia is trying to help both Bernie Sanders and Trump, they're going to have to prove it to the American public. So they're going to have to show just enough to convince the public that this is happening. And so they're going to have to release some things. What are they going to release? What's that going to look like? Or are they not going to release anything because they don't have anything that's good enough to show the American public? This will show us just how sophisticated they are and how many people are involved and the kind of intelligence that's behind it. So it'll be interesting to watch for sure. So that's the take. Now you're up to speed. You know what's going on in politics, and we'll see. There's a lot more to come. We'll be back here in just a minute. back with segment two of the Pilgrim Show. As we dig into technology and privacy, all things like that. There's quite a few different stories here today, so I'm not sure exactly how I'm going to attack this, other than maybe just to talk about what I'm seeing out there. Maybe just go through some of this little by little. Apple has announced that it's going to, in Safari, start to look at HTTPS SSL certificates and start dropping some of them based on how long they're valid for. So let me explain how this works. So when you hit a website that's encrypted, which today pretty much most sites, if not all, should be HTTPS at this point. So in your browser at the top left in the URL bar, there's a little lock to the left of a URL if it is using HTTPS. And that S stands for, what does it stand for? SSL? Maybe? Secure? I forget. Now I feel like a doofus. Anyways. So an SSL certificate allows your connection to that web page to be encrypted. And this is really, really important if you enter any information that's sensitive, because you don't want prying eyes to see it. So the trick with these SSL certificates is that you basically set when they're valid from and when they're valid to. So you can say, this certificate is valid for one day. The certificate, which is incredibly rare. The certificate is valid for a week, for a month, for a year, for 3 years, for 8 years, for 12 years, for 20 years. And generally, certificates that are valid for a really, really long time are frowned upon for good reason. You don't want to have a certificate that never expires, because 15 years from now, somebody could go use that certificate and it would still be valid. So Safari is going to try to combat this kind of practice of making really long certificates by not accepting HTTPS certificates that expire more than 13 months from their creation date. So it's from the creation date. It's not from when it's when it's due. If the certificate has more than 13 months of valid time, it's not going to work in Safari. So that's cool. This is good. This is a really good thing. Website admins generally have certificates renew automatically anyway. It's not difficult to do. It's really, you can do it at any time. It doesn't interfere with anything. Like, why is this not a thing? Now, one of the downsides is this forces certain behaviors on website admins. And some website admins may be really upset about this. I think it's a good thing. Next up, the FBI recommends passphrases over password complexity. And password practices are always a good thing to review. And there, in this article, there's actually a cartoon, which I've seen before, that talks about passphrases versus passwords. So if you think about this, commonly up to this point, what we've been told about passwords is that you should have a really complex password. And to do that complexity, you need to have uppercase characters and lowercase characters and numbers and special characters. And the more characters you have and the less frequency, the better. And then if you have two characters that are of the same type next to each other, that could be a bad thing. And so you want it to be really, really complex. The problem with this is that it's also hard to remember. These long, complex passwords are hard to remember. So this cartoon shows a complex password with like uppercase T, lowercase R, 0, lowercase U, lowercase B, number 4, lowercase D, lowercase O, lowercase R, ampersand 3. And that's the password that I use, you know. Okay, so So it uses caps here and there, and then common substitutions for, you know, numbers for letters. And then it gives some stats. It says, you know, 28 bits of entropy. This would take 3 days at 1,000 guesses per second to figure out. Difficulty to guess, based on computer ability, really easy. Difficulty to remember, really, really hard. And it has this picture of a person here, says, was it a trombone? No, a troubadour. And one of the O's was a zero, and there was some symbol. Yeah, hard to remember. So what they recommend is a phrase instead. So they use the example of correct horse battery staple. All lowercase letters all run together. 44 bits of entropy. It would take 550 years at 1,000 guesses a second to get it right. Difficulty to guess for the computer is hard. Difficulty to remember, it has a picture of a person with a thought bubble that has a horse looking at a battery. The horse says, that's a battery staple. There's a staple in the battery. There's a staple in the battery. And then the person thinks, correct. So it's correct horse battery staple. And he's already memorized it. So this is something I've seen before, and there's definitely something to it. The longer the password, the harder it is for a computer to guess it. But it doesn't have to be super, super, super complex. It just has to be long. So, you know, we should maybe start requiring 20-character passwords and just tell people, look, it doesn't have to be, you know, super complex. It just has to be at least 20 characters long. And there you go. Now, you can remember passwords. If you can come up with a way to remember your passwords, that's really, really valuable. Alternatively, you need to use a password manager or some combination of the two. Because as this article poses, sometimes people write passwords down on a sticky note. Actually, it was a different article I was reading, completely unrelated. Never mind. Sometimes people write passwords down on a sticky note. Sometimes they store them like in a spreadsheet, which is like a really horrible thing to do. So all of those kinds of things can happen. In other news, Microsoft brings Windows Defender antivirus to Linux, and soon they're going to bring it out for Android and iOS. Okay. Defender antivirus is their Windows antivirus that's like built into Windows. Well, they have it now for Linux. And if you run Linux, you can run Microsoft Defender antivirus for Linux. This seems counterintuitive, except that Linux is really important in Microsoft's infrastructure. Microsoft understands and recognizes that not only is Linux not going anywhere, it's important. And everybody, even Microsoft people, are going to need to use it at some point. The reason is because of the direction of cloud hosting. Computers and containers and systems are just exploding on the internet. Cloud is just blowing up. This is the age of cloud, which we'll talk a little bit about too here in a minute. And in the age of cloud, Linux is vital. You have to have Linux. It's just going to be everywhere. So Microsoft looks at this and they're like, well, you know, we need to embrace this thing. So they actually do support Linux in a number of different ways. You can run Linux in Windows much easier now than you used to be able to. You can have a terminal access directly in Windows and so forth. And that allows for SSH and all those kinds of things. They've been developing a lot of this recently. So antivirus for Linux kind of makes sense in this case. If you are a Microsoft shop and you're used to the paradigm that antivirus is necessary and we need to have antivirus on everything, then it kind of makes sense to say, well, let's use Defender antivirus for Linux. There is a difference in paradigm, however. I'd like to point out that a lot of Linux people don't believe in antivirus. And I land somewhere in the middle on this, so I'm just going to present both sides of this thing. Some people say that antivirus is critical. If you're going to have any sort of infrastructure, anything enterprise, you have to have antivirus on every device. The thinking being, we need to be able to detect the antivirus, detect viruses, and stop them. My view is that you need to have antivirus on Windows, but that in other places, antivirus is not the only or necessarily the right solution. Some antiviruses have been known to have major vulnerabilities, and it's just an additional piece of software that you're putting on your systems that opens you up to vulnerabilities. Antivirus is not going to always catch everything. It's going to catch viruses. It's going to catch code that's known to be bad. But it also is just an additional way that people can use for malicious content. And it's not going to stop ransomware today. Antiviruses don't catch ransomware. It's not going to catch those people who are genuinely trying to use backdoors and attack and get into your network. So it depends on your needs and it depends on your security practices. Antivirus may not be right for Linux. For Mac OS, it depends a little bit because that tends to open itself up. The biggest thing with Mac OS, there is a piece of malware that's really, really prominent on Mac, but it only gets there if you click on allow or you install it with other pieces of software. So if you, as a user, have good practices, you don't need antivirus on Mac. You really don't. On Windows, it's a little bit of a different story because there's such a huge attack vector in the Microsoft operating system that there are so many different ways that bad code can get onto a Windows computer. It is virtually impossible to verify that a Windows computer is not infected. Unless you have a baseline and you can compare it to a baseline. So you have to off network, take a Microsoft ISO, Windows ISO, and build an image, and then here's my baseline. And then you can use tools to compare to make sure that a computer is clean or safe. But that's a lot of work, and most people aren't doing that. So antivirus is really, really critical for Microsoft Windows computers. But it is kind of interesting that Microsoft is putting this much into Linux and that its antivirus is actually going somewhere because it's often also been said that you shouldn't have an antivirus solution from the same vendor as your operating system. So Microsoft builds the OS. They shouldn't be necessarily the ones building the antivirus. There's some validity to that argument. I think also the thing you have to be aware is that Microsoft knows more about their OS, so them securing it isn't a bad thing. So I'm not sure. You make of that what you want. There's a lot of different views on that. There is a Kickstarter for an IoT candle. It's a real candle. It has a flame, and it has an app, so you can take your cell phone and start your candle. Light your candle from your phone. Literally light your candle from your phone. And it's a candle. It's real flame. It's not like some... Yeah. So that's great, but you can imagine the implications. What if this technology could be used for other things? There could be a lot of things you could use this technology for. You could take this same candle, you could buy the candle, you could put it somewhere and use it to start something else or blow something up. This is the world we live in, the IoT world of doing everything from your phone. So you're going to walk into a room, turn the lights on from your phone, unlock your door from your phone. You can use Bluetooth proximity to determine where you are and then take certain IoT actions with that. So who knows where this is all going with IoT. Just thought it would be interesting to mention that. Iranian hackers exploited a VPN flaw into organizations around the world. And I mentioned this because, not because I want to talk about VPN flaws, although that is a big deal. And, you know, you want to be careful with how you set up your VPN and how many people you give access to your VPN and how you secure it and all of those things. But also to say that this was a VPN there was a backdoor. They were able to backdoor these VPNs and get into all kinds of organizations. And there's this huge debate right now about encryption in communication mechanisms and all of these kinds of things, messaging and everything. Let's encrypt everything, and then the government's like, don't encrypt it, and if you do encrypt it, give us a backdoor. As soon as the government has a backdoor, every government has a backdoor. As soon as one government, the good guys have us a backdoor, then Iranian hackers are going to exploit those kinds of backdoors as well. Just something to keep in your minds as you think about those kinds of things. All right, so there's some news around privacy of movement. And there was a ZDNet article here about a guy who's looking into the fact that these local police organizations, there was a report somewhere. It was a report. Local police authorities in California. There were four local police authorities in California that were audited for their license plate tracking systems. And of course, you know, the police scan license plates in a lot of areas, and of course they track movement of those, you know, they were in this place and then they were in this place, those kinds of things. And in the article, he says, my emotions, though, still aren't aligned with former Google chairman Eric Schmidt's. He insisted that if you have something that you don't want to, anyone to know, maybe you shouldn't be doing it in the first place. And this is the argument that a lot of people have with privacy, is that, you know, you don't need to have any privacy, because if you're doing something that you don't want the whole world to know, then you shouldn't do it. I think this is kind of ridiculous. I think it's completely ridiculous. And yeah, there's this thing called integrity, and we should have integrity. But I think that we should have a right to not have the whole world know what we don't want the whole world to know about ourselves. Maybe you have things you just don't want the world to know about you. That should be okay. It should be okay to have a personal life, to walk into your home and close the door. And, you know, maybe even go to a grocery store and buy things that you want to eat and not worry about being judged for that, or people knowing that you like cookies. Like, these kinds of things like aren't for the world to know. And some people just don't. I mean, there's different views on this, right? So there was an audit here that about these license plate readers, looking at the systems that store the data of these license plates and what happens to that data. Here's a sentence from the report. None of these agencies had audited searches of the ALPR images by their staff, and thus had no assurance that the searches were appropriate. So any officer from any of these agencies could look up any license plate at any time and see not only the license plate, but also a lot of other information about that license plate, where that person has been, and so forth. The report goes on to say, three of the four agencies have shared their ALPR images widely without considering whether the entities receiving them might have a right to the need for the image. In other words, it's not just law enforcement that has access to this data. So he says comically in the article, he says, you mean someone maybe or maybe not a law enforcement officer in, say, Florida knows where I go to Starbucks? And the report goes on to say, we found that in Sacramento and Los Angeles were adding names, addresses, dates of birth, and criminal charges to their ALPR systems, which are then stored in those systems. So this is just one audit, but I would venture to say that this is happening in a lot more places than this audit. This was just for police agencies that were looked at. So maybe an indicator about how police authorities around the country operate. This was another part of the article. It says, we did not find evidence that the agencies had always determined whether an entity receiving shared images had a right and need to access the images, or even that the entity was a public agency. So that's great. You know, we've got this down. We've got data of movement anywhere in the world. So for hackers that are out there that want to find information on people, this is the kind of data that is on the dark web that they can just grab. So as you drive down the street, not only are you able to pick up, you know, your license plate gets picked up on businesses that have these kinds of cameras, but every time you drive past a cop and they grab your plate and it goes into that system, all of that information is put up there. So something just to keep in mind, and I don't know how you fix this. I don't think we will ever fix this. Even if you start to put laws in place, moving around, even today, even in a country like the United States, in populated areas, has the real potential that your license plates can retract, and the whole world is going to have the ability to know where you go. So I don't know. I don't know what to do with that information, but there are some legislatures who are pushing back against this whole privacy of movement issue. One of them is Washington State. And the Washington State Senate is working on legislation, and they actually passed a bill here to regulate facial recognition software in the state of Washington. It prohibits state and local law enforcement agencies from using facial recognition in most cases. So they're not allowed to do ongoing surveillance with facial recognition, and they're not allowed to do persistent tracking. This is pretty cool, actually. The bill sort of regulates the implementation of any facial recognition software, and if there is facial recognition software that's used, it has to be, 90 days? At least 90 days before they adopt it, they have to inform the public of the new technology in question in detail. So that's cool, too. So that if government agencies are going to implement certain technologies that involve facial recognition, they have to inform the public within 90 days, before 90 days before implementing it, that this is the software we're exploring, and these are the features of it, and this is how it works. Which allows then for the public to respond to that technology. Pretty cool stuff, actually. I don't know how this is going to play out in other states. Of course, that's a state law. And, you know, some places you might, it might be one of those things where you start to vote with your feet, where, you know, some states really protect against facial recognition privacy concerns, and others just don't. So we'll see. Could be interesting. Facebook has an approach here to content moderation that I want to talk a little bit about. So I think what I'll do is I'm going to go a little bit long in this segment, just a few minutes long in this segment, and shorten up my last segment. And because I want to talk about this issue with Facebook. Facebook has an approach to content moderation that is really kind of concerning. And part of it is they're working on creating a third-party, and I want to find the quote here. They're building a third-party group that's going to moderate some of these things. I'm trying to find where that was in this article here. The need for external oversight on content moderation policies. Facebook is already working on an independent oversight board. Here it is, which it likened to a Supreme Court to oversee some of the platform's moderation decisions, publishing periodic reports on law enforcement policies. Again, the social media giant has its own community standards. Okay, so Facebook is working on an independent oversight board. Okay, so when there is an issue of privacy, like moderation. So this is moderation. So when there's an issue like vaccines, and let's talk about vaccines. Let's have a conversation about vaccines. And Facebook says, don't have a conversation about vaccines. You're not allowed to have a conversation about vaccines. Then that's going to go to an independent oversight board. And that board, whoever's on that board, is likened to a Supreme Court. They essentially get to decide what is allowed as conversation on Facebook and what is not allowed as conversation on Facebook. So sure, we want to prevent terrorist groups from being able to communicate on Facebook. That's a nice idea. But then we also want to prevent anyone from questioning certain authorities. We cannot have any checks and balances on the medical industry. Not allowed. We cannot have any checks and balances on the scientific community. That's not allowed. If it is science, we're not allowed to touch it. We're not allowed to talk about it. If it is, that's just the way it is. So where do you draw the line then? At what point does religion play into this? So I just needed to mention that because it's quite a big deal. That's really all I had to say. It's a big deal. Facebook moderating their content, and Facebook isn't the only one doing it. They just happen to be the biggest player in the social media world. So with all of that said, that is sort of a picture of where we are in privacy and with technology currently. So we'll be back here in a minute to talk about the pilgrim of animal behavior. Back now for the final segment of the Pilgrim Show, the segment where I talk about the Guru Pilgrim stuff, the different interests and fascinations that I have, and the reasons for them. And today I want to talk about animal behavior, and this is the next on the circle of interests that I have, and animal behavior falls after psychology here, and I don't think I have to explain the connection between psychology and animal behavior. Obviously, animal behavior is very connected to cognitive psychology, and basically is that science. But it moves along in the circle of interests here, and there's quite a bit to talk about as far as animal behavior. First of all, why does it matter? What is it about animal behavior that means anything to anybody? Why would we study it? I think the biggest thing, as a creationist and as a believer in the Bible, having a better understanding of how animals behave and how they think and how they work has a really valuable impact on our understanding of what creatures are, which then helps us to understand what we are. The Bible lays out a distinction between humans and all other creatures on Earth. So what is the difference? And the better and more clear that we understand that difference, the better we'll be able to understand ourselves. And a lot of times, you know, biblicists will just excuse the concept of animals having feelings or emotions, and nothing could be further from the truth. It's very easy to observe and make observation of animals having feelings and emotions and wants and needs and desires and thoughts. Animals think. Animals learn. As an example, I remember training a Sheltie once to stay inside of an electric fence. You know, you train the dog to stay inside of the fence. Every time they go close to that fence, they get shocked. Well, we walked this dog around the border a number of times, day after day, and it made no difference. And although the dog knew that there was a border and that area, you would get shocked whenever you went in this area, it couldn't connect the concept of that border being a barrier. It just wasn't clicking over and over again. And finally, the dog would just run across the border and get shocked and not know what's going on and then not want to come back across the border and all of that. So finally, just one day we were training the dog and working with it, and it was getting close to that border and getting shocked, and it was really upset. You could tell it was just frustrated dog and just really annoyed. Put it in the doghouse for the night, and the next day, it was like this dog had thought about those experiences. It was like it had analyzed what was going on. When I go in this area, I get shocked, and the dog just kind of, it's like it thought about it, and then it clicked. And it wasn't like we were training it, and then it learned something behavioral instinctively. It was like this next day the dog wakes up and stays inside of the fence, and there's no problem following that. That's an example of a dog learning through thinking and analyzing a situation. So creatures definitely do this, and the more we study it, the more we learn about it. The other thing that's fascinating is we learn a lot about intelligence itself. You know, when you're stuck to the confines of human intelligence, and there's the IQ test and all of these things, you're essentially limiting the concept of intelligence to human terms. Studying animal behavior and the intelligence of animals specifically, you can learn a lot about what intelligence is, because you have to think about intelligence in different ways. A dolphin can't write a number. It can do math, but it can't write the answer down. Same with elephants or chimpanzees. And so you learn a lot about intelligence itself. And there are, I want to talk a little bit about the animal behavior today. And I know there are different species that are being looked into. There's a lot of research around chimpanzees and elephants and octopuses as well. To figure out what they're capable of doing, and all kinds of tests that will be done on these creatures. But dolphins in particular, there's a lot of research around, and for good reason. Dolphins have a lot of intelligence. There's a lot that they bring to the table. And so dolphin research is something I've been very interested in, particularly around the issue of intelligence. And it's been an ongoing field of study for a number of decades, but it has its stigmas. Dolphins by themselves, that's a whole world just in itself. There are tensions and stresses around that whole industry from every direction. It's one of the most stigmatized fields of study in the world, is dolphin research, and very, very heated, and internationally so. You have what's happening in Japan, where there's international laws about what you can and can't do in regard to fisheries and dolphins, and Japan essentially ignores those laws and doesn't enforce them for their own people. So in their waters, whole pods of dolphins are killed, and then because they can't sell it as dolphin meat, and because most people wouldn't buy it as dolphin meat, they call it whale meat, which is technically not inaccurate. Dolphins are whales, but it's sold as if it's whale meat, you know, captured legally and so forth, in the markets in Japan. So that's something that's going on, and so the international community has this huge heated debate about what to do about this and other things. There's all the conservation efforts and everything around dolphins. There's also hugely different views in regard to whether or not to keep dolphins in captivity and other things around dolphins. So, for instance, the captive dolphin stigma. The closest aquarium to us is the Baltimore Aquarium, the National Aquarium in Baltimore. And they are in the process of preparing to move their dolphins to a seaside aquarium because of public pressure. And it's sad because this is actually a very, very tricky move. These dolphins really shouldn't be moved. It's going to be up to this point, what they do is they have the National Aquarium has a rescue program by the seaside. And if there are dolphins there that are rescued, they stay in a seaside area. The problem is dolphins that have been in captivity have been in captivity for so many decades that they have different sets of immunities, the dolphins that have been out in the ocean. There are diseases out in the ocean today that weren't out there 60 years ago. And so dolphins that are in captivity don't have immunities to those diseases, and they're very careful not to introduce captive dolphins to wild ones or wild dolphins to captive ones for that reason. There are also diseases that the captive dolphins have built up immunities to that the wild dolphins would not have. So even they have a rule in the National Aquarium, at least last that I heard, that workers who work in the rescue program are not allowed to work directly with the dolphins in the aquarium and vice versa. So they're very careful not to introduce diseases between these two populations. So now to move these dolphins to a seaside aquarium means that they have to take into account the health of these dolphins and find some way to introduce these diseases in a safe way so that the dolphin isn't harmed by it. It really is a really difficult thing to try to move. But because of so much public pressure, they feel it's necessary to do it, which is really sad to see. To me, I think there's value in having aquariums for a number of reasons. And one of them would be the research value that you get. You cannot study a dolphin in a seaside aquarium. You could do it. So there's nothing really wrong with seaside aquariums. The value of aquariums of any kind is, number one, the research that you can get from that. Having the ability to have the dolphins in a smaller enclosure and do tests with them and train them and work with them. The cognitive research that you can do with them is immensely more powerful. And you can also do things like attach suction cups to the dolphins to do analysis with sensors and so forth, which allows for much, much greater and safer implementation of some of these tests when you're in an aquarium. The other big thing that you get with an aquarium is the inspiration that it gives to other people, young people, and they get to see these dolphins firsthand, up close and personal. And if we're not inspiring the next generation to take care of these dolphins, and really the oceans as well, then what are we really left with? We take the dolphins out of the aquarium, and that's the main attraction. And so they don't get to see, if you take the dolphins away, they don't get to see all the other life and value in the oceans, because they just won't be as interesting, and they won't be drawn to it. So that's my argument. I just think it's destructive to get rid of the captive dolphin population. I don't see it happening around the world very quickly, but there definitely is a movement, and aquariums are giving into the pressure in significant ways. So it's just a tricky situation to find yourself in. Again, seaside aquariums, that's definitely not going anywhere for a long, long time, but there's something there. So there's a stigma around that. There's also a stigma in the dolphin research community in regard to intelligence research because of the early days of dolphin research. Back in the day with dolphin research, there were not a lot of people doing it. And sadly, the people that got involved in dolphin research were not the greatest people. And there were issues with drugs, and there were issues with really bizarre problems and financial theft and so forth. I mean, it was a really rough time, and it set the stage for dolphin research in such a way that when people thought about dolphin research, they associated it with this horrendous kind of person or way of thinking. And so there's a stigma around just even the concept of dolphin research. Well, I think it's come a long, long way. That's definitely something to worry about. The other thing is there have been issues of captive dolphins really being abused. And although it's rarely the case today, there was a story maybe 10 years ago about the Barcelona Aquarium having some huge abuses of their dolphins. So it's not out of the question that it might happen in captive aquariums and so forth, where you have improper care. It can happen. Certainly if you have someone whose job it is to be responsible for the dolphins, and the money and the reputation of the aquarium is at stake, you would hope that they would do a really good job of maintaining a good, healthy population of their dolphins. But you just never know. Sometimes people just are bad people. There are bad people in the world. So with all of those stigmas in mind, it's kind of unfortunate that they're all there, because dolphins are immensely intelligent creatures. And there's a lot of research that's being done with dolphins, and it's really, really valuable research. And for the reasons I stated at the beginning here, understanding how dolphins think and how intelligent they are is really, really useful. It helps us to understand intelligence itself and all the things that go with it. Now, there are two different views even within that community, and you can look at the same data and see it in two different ways, or really on a scale. So there are those who think that dolphins are so intelligent that they are just waiting to talk to humans. They have their own language, and they can communicate with each other, and all we have to do is bridge the gap. And if we could just figure out how to communicate with them, we'd be able to have half-hour conversations and learn from them, and they're so intelligent that they could show us up in some areas. And then there's the other side, the other extreme, which would say that no, dolphins are really just fish, and they just happen to be a little bit smarter than other fish. So obviously those two extremes are both faulty. Dolphins are very intelligent creatures. However, they do have some challenges with some basic things. Object permanence is something that dolphins actually don't have. So as well as they can see things with with their minds, essentially, with the melon, they can use sonar to see texture and see things through other things and all of that. But once you present them with an object and then you hide it, they have no idea where it is. You could put it in, you know, you take a ball, you show them the ball, you put the ball in a bucket and you ask them where it is and they have no idea. They think that it's gone. So object permanence seems like something that they would have, but they don't. And then there's the mirror test. And the mirror test is a really good example of the extremes and how different even researchers can view the intelligence of dolphins. The mirror test has been done by countless people with dolphins. And I heard one researcher say that, you know, clearly the mirror test proves that dolphins can see themselves in the mirror. They recognize themselves in the mirror just as quickly as humans do. And this proves that they really are just as smart as humans. And the Dolphin Research Center in Florida, though, has contradictory evidence. And the DRC has done the mirror test, and they say that it's inconclusive. Some dolphins can do it, other dolphins can't. And so one individual will see himself in the mirror and say, yep, that's me. I can move my flipper, and I can see myself move in the mirror. That's pretty cool. Another dolphin will come by and like, wait, who's that? What dolphin is that? So they've demonstrated that it's not a great conclusive answer on the mirror test, which is an indication that dolphins aren't quite all that smart as humans are. They use tools, and they're capable of using tools, but it seems if they were as intelligent as humans, they would be using those tools to do more than they're doing. They definitely use them for things, but generally, dolphins learn how to use tools from their peers. They don't generally invent a lot of tools themselves. There'll be a pod that knows how to use seaweed as a tool, and another one will use something else as a tool. It's just they learn from each other a lot. Okay, so just in to wrap this all up, there is research that I would love to do on animal behavior. And specifically, I'm interested in taking border collies and looking at what, now we know them to be very intelligent, but I want to try to compare border collies to other species in their intelligence. So I want to take some of the same tests that have been done with chimpanzees and elephants and dolphins and octopuses. And octopi, I guess it would be, and do that with border collies, because I want to see if you use the same tests, what the outcome would be. And a lot of the tests you could do directly with border collies, but some of this research would also involve developing some of my own tests that would be able to be performed across species. The trick with doing this kind of research is, again, they can't write down an answer. And if you're dealing with a dog and a dolphin, they both have a snout, but an octopus doesn't have a snout. So what do you do there? So the kinds of things that you do with them to develop a standardized method of coming up with intelligence, you have to think outside of the box. And that's the kind of work that I would really like to do, because there's another aspect of this that I'm interested in, and that is the work of intelligence. If you have intelligence, you can use your mind to do work. So, for instance, a lot of people have office jobs, or they have jobs where they sit at a computer and they use their mind to perform work. Now, what if we could take that concept of intelligence, and let's say we take a dog. Now, dogs have jobs and so forth. But what if we could give them a job, maybe through the use of a computer and some sort of interface with them, that would allow the dog to perform intelligence work, intelligence kinds of work? You present them with certain kinds of problems to solve, and they have to solve it. Not that it would be to the level of what a human could do, but it would be interesting to see if there would be value in giving a dog that kind of work, because someday maybe we could give intellectual work to dogs and have them do it for us. And I mean, the cost would be feeding them rather than a salary of a human being. So it's just an interesting theory that I have. It should be interesting to explore that and see what the results would be. So that is animal behavior. Those are the things that really have interested me recently, and what I'd like to do in that whole world. Thanks for listening to the show, and we will be back next week with a whole lot more exciting content. This is The Pilgrim Show. I'm Nate Moss. See you later.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.